Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. It's entirely possible that this is the only thing we're going to hear from Jay Powell on this program today.
You know, we have the ability to be careful at this point and move carefully, and that's what we're planning to do.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 20th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And look, just because I said we might not hear more from Jay Powell today does not mean we are not going to talk about the Fed's announcement on interest rates and this economy. We're just going to do it different. A couple of weeks ago, before the central bank went into its usual pre-meeting quiet period, we got Austin Goolsbee on the phone. He's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, of course, and I asked him about what he calls the golden path, which is Goolsbee speak for soft landing. All right, so look, if you're saying it's possible to get on the golden path, I have to ask you how much more you need to see, because inflation has come down precipitously. The job market, as you know, is still strong. Some signs of it weakening, which is what you guys want to see. The economy is growing. What more do you want to see?
Yay to all of those. We're getting more supply and demand, more back into balance. But the overall level of inflation is still above where we want it to be.
And he went on, because he's a talker,
there's clearly risks. I mean, if you look at China, if you look, we could have a government shutdown. There are a whole series of bumps in the road that we will have to navigate.
All right. That was a lot, I know, but bear with me.
Would the AirPods work or not? Okay, I'll just do it like this.
This is Steve Ferrazzi.
So I'm just a professor teaching and research and thinking about the Fed.
He's a professor of economics at Washington University in St. Louis. And we asked him what it is going to take for the Fed to just take the win.
It's hard to tell because there's so much volatility month to month, quarter to quarter, in all sorts of prices. It can be housing, it can be energy, it can be food. It's got to be a more sustained period when we see inflation, not much above 2%. If it's 2.2 or 2.3 or 2.5, given the volatility, I think it's probably fine. But they say they want 2%.
They want 2. They've got 3.7 right now, just by way of reminder. Same question. What's it going to take?
We are all good. We are recording.
Went to Kara McDaniel. She's at Arizona State.
I would be looking for persistently good numbers. Persistently low, not just one, and maybe not just two, but persistent low levels of core inflation.
Okay, but when?
Your guess is as good as mine. I would say, I mean, months, right? You know, months and months.
Here's why the when matters.
Yeah, I have a nice students. How do you think the Fed is doing? They're like, the prices are still going up. So I don't know what you're talking about, that the Fed is doing very well.
The students in question study with Golnaz Moti at Western Kentucky University.
To control inflation is to control expectation. If you haven't managed to control people's expectation, you still have a way to go.
Inflation expectations are right now, and to be clear, anchored, as economists and Jay Powell like to say. But they are anchored, according to the most recent University of Michigan survey of consumer sentiment, at better than 3%. The Fed's announcement and the Jay Powell press conference that followed was a bit of an anchor on stocks today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. As we've remarked the past couple of days, September is barely half over yet. The retail industry is already getting ready for the holidays. Amazon's looking to add 250,000 people. That's almost 70% more than last year. Target is staying with the 100,000 it hired last year. Macy's is down just a bit. Kind of a mixed bag that actually does offer us some insights as to how retailers are feeling right now. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes it from there.
Amazon is desperate to hire, so much that Afori Agboka, a company vice president, had one message and one message only during our call.
We encourage people to go to Amazon.com/apply. Go to Amazon.com/apply. Amazon.com/apply.
Message delivered, I guess. Amazon, which is a marketplace underwriter, has opened 50 new facilities this year. And Agboka says the company expects customers to spend more.
Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. You know, we believe they're going to be higher numbers.
So far, that puts Amazon on an island. Other major retailers are either hiring the same number of seasonal workers as last year or less. Andy Challenger at the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas says many haven't made announcements at all.
The fact that they have been taking so long to make those announcements could be an indicator that it's going to be a slower holiday hiring season.
Slower because of uncertainty, years of it. Jessica Ramirez is an analyst at Jane Hawley & Associates.
The first year, if you think about it, during the pandemic, we didn't have inventory, so you were advised to shop early. Last year, we had too much inventory, so we were trying to get things out the door. And this year, the consumer is likely going to space out their shopping.
Because inflation is straining people's wallets. Also, Ramirez says retailers are still figuring out how to staff warehouses and stores as consumers switch between shopping in person and online and using curbside pickup.
I don't feel it's as straightforward as it used to be or how we would want it to be.
Jesse Wheeler, an economist at Morning Consult, says this adds to retailers' uncertainty.
And with wage growth still strong, they will certainly lead them to be maybe more on the cautious side when laying out their hiring plans this season.
He says temporary workers can be a bellwether for the economy. And right now, it's saying sit back, hold tight, things are still confusing. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Unless you're a currency trader, you probably don't have this one in your tickler file. Friday is the one-year anniversary of a kind of an unusual move by the Japanese government. It bought up a bunch of yen, trying to prop up the value of its currency, and in the process, by the way, making everything Japan imports less expensive. The yen had been falling against the dollar because, in large part, the Bank of Japan had to be keeping interest rates low, and the Federal Reserve, well, as we all know, hadn't. You fast forward to today, the yen is falling again, and this week Japan kind of hinted it might get back into the foreign exchange markets. The United States is rarely cool with other countries intervening like that, but Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen did say this week the Biden administration might understand if Japan decides to do something. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the Treasury Department's opinions on the currency markets kind of depend on the details.
The U.S. has a few reasons to be concerned if a country tries to influence its own currency.
They're particularly concerned about countries that try to keep their currency low to make their exports more competitive.
That's Mary Lovely, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Lovely says if another country tries to manipulate their currency down and make their exports cheaper, that can give them an unfair advantage, which ticks off the U.S. government, American companies, and workers.
Because they feel that it creates a situation where competition between firms is not based on market conditions. It's based on government decisions to intervene in the currency market.
The U.S. has a history of accusing China of currency manipulation, but Japan is a different story. For one, our political relationships are very different. And two, Japan is trying to boost its currency, not deflate it. Takatoshi Ito, a professor at Columbia, says that's just not as concerning to the U.S.
Because it doesn't threaten U.S. industries.
Ito says Japan is also trying to make the yen more stable.
For not only Japanese investors and exporters, but also the global trading system.
If the yen jumps around too much, anyone that wants to trade with Japan might hold off. Supply chains could seize up. Catherine Dominguez, a professor at the University of Michigan, says this is not the time for that to happen.
The world economy is fragile, and the U.S. feels it would be in their best interest for all of the, especially advanced economies, to continue to thrive.
Dominguez says a stronger yen could boost the Japanese economy. That's because Japan imports a lot of products, especially energy and raw materials.
So as the yen appreciates, they basically have to spend less yen in order to purchase the same amount of fuel and raw materials.
And Dominguez says a stronger Japanese economy could increase demand for American products. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Once they've got the technology basically down, maybe the key question for AI companies is to anthropomorphize or not to anthropomorphize. There is, of course, the very non-human and very technobot-sounding ChatGPT. Google has gone the Shakespearean route, naming its AI interlocutor Bard. And then there's Claude, from a company kind of appropriately called Anthropic. Technology companies and venture capitalists have spent hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars developing their AI products. Now, of course, they have to persuade us to use them. And step one is finding the right name. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
Long before ChatGPT, even before Alexa and Cortana and Siri, the AI most Americans knew on a first name basis was
Watson.
Watson, the IBM supercomputer that destroyed Ken Jennings and the rest of the meat puppet competition on Jeopardy back in 2011.
Watson.
Who is Henry VIII?
You are right again. Watson.
What is the elegance of the hedgehog?
You are right.
Dave Ferrucci led the team at IBM that developed Watson when he wasn't in one of the many, many meetings with the marketing team.
You don't realize how much consternation just goes into this naming thing.
Ferrucci remembers rounds of debate between a few names. I bet you can guess one of the other leading candidates.
People were talking about Sherlock.
Sherlock, of course, is the titular star, the brilliant one, the guy who actually solves the murder. And that's not really the role Ferrucci envisioned for AI.
I like the notion that computers were helping humans make better decisions and helping humans collect the facts and things like that.
Watson was impressive, but this new wave of generative AI tools can do a lot more, write legal memos, win art competitions, which presents some dilemmas for branding teams, lean into the power of the tech, or reassure anxious customers that you're here to help them, not replace them. Katie Steinmetz is a project director at Catchword Branding.
So on the one hand, you have something like Microsoft has Copilot.
Copilot is a new AI tool for Word and Excel.
It's Copilot. It is not Autopilot.
And on the other hand, you have consulting from McKinsey's AI service, Quantum Black, a name that says, we're like Skynet from the Terminator movies, only more terrifying. Steinmetz says the decision to use a human name can make your AI sound more relatable and friendly, but it also raises expectations.
It invites you to think about the chatbot as an entity, as an individual, you know, as someone who can understand nuance as a human could, and that could be overpromising depending on the company.
She says companies that are christening their AI with human names are increasingly going gender neutral or male. Siri and Alexa were criticized for reinforcing sexist tropes of women as helpers and assistants. The male names have to strike the right tone, though. You're probably not going to see Genghis GPT anytime soon.
I think you look at a name like Claude, right, from Anthropic. I would say it's a kind of gentle male name. If we know any Claude, it's probably Claude Monet. Nice painting, maybe a little too French for you, right? But it doesn't at all sound threatening.
There's another dimension to choosing a human name tech companies have sometimes neglected, the actual humans.
It got a lot easier at some point to go by Lex. There's a certain point where you want to stop hearing the same joke about your name.
Lex Vaughn is a writer and editor of The Needling, a humor website in Seattle. But back in 2006, when we first became friends, I knew her as Alexa. That was well before things like this started happening.
I've had friends, you know, like FaceTime their kids when they're visiting me, and they think I am the Alexa.
While it was funny to tell kids to ask her anything, it slowly dawned on Alexa that a whole generation would associate her with a digital servant. Alexa switched to Lex a few years ago, and it's working for her. Well, at least for now.
Don't get mad at me. Part of the reason I reached out to you specifically, I'm going to forward you something. And I just want to get your reaction to this. Okay?
Oh, boy.
Read it out loud.
Okay. Hey, yeah. Matt. You're getting this email because you signed up for Lex. Oh,
no. Lex is also the name of a new AI writing assistant. Human Lex won't be using it for her job anytime soon. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Well, that piece took a turn, didn't it? Coming up.
Some of them are, you know, not overly concerned with the truth.
Caveat emptor indeed. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 76 today, 0.2%, 34,440. The NASDAQ down 209, 1.5%, 13,469. The S&P 500 subtracted 41 points, rather, 0.9%, 44.2 there. The office furniture maker Steelcase surged 19%. It posted better than predicted second quarter earnings and issued strong forward guidance. General Mills is the proud purveyor of such food as Dunkaroos and Annie's Organic Cheddar Bunnies, whatever those are. The company posted first quarter results that were slightly tastier than expected. Shares barely budged. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's new data out today from Pew about Latinos in the United States and how, for our purposes, they participate in this economy. 75% of the 64 million Latinos here can carry on a conversation in Spanish pretty well or very well, Pew says. 63% of them speak Spanglish at least sometimes. There's also data on language as a marker of cultural identity and how Latinos who don't speak Spanish feel about it. But as the demographics of this country change, Latinos are now just about 20% of the population and growing. Language is really a business opportunity, and advertisers are paying close attention to that language, whether it's Spanish, English, or something in between. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has that one.
In a new Colgate ad, two girls with braces, nervous about school picture day, smile at each other. Then the voiceover says,
sonreír primero can help someone find the courage para hacer lo mismo.
The Spanglish ads have impressed Janina Volpe with ad agency Kramer Krasselt.
A Spanglish spot that is working is something for us to not only celebrate culturally, but for us business-minded nerds such as myself to really investigate.
Using Spanish is down to a science for Vertigo Media Group's Lisa Mirable on Long Island, New York, who tests ads. She says while grandma prefers them 100% in Spanish, for the next generation,
you're still kind of like at a 30%
a range of Spanish to English.
And the grandkids?
They're very loyal and very proud of the heritage. So we run Spanglish ads as well. But at this point, we're running more of like an 8% Spanish to English mix.
Small and large corporations are investing in Spanglish ads, says Vaquero Advertising's Fernando Alvarez. They're for kids who grew up speaking English.
But every time that they come to their grandparents' house that are Mexican or, you know, Puerto Rican or Cuban or Argentinian, they were listening to Spanish every single day and they were learning it.
And Juan Alanis of Big Oak Tree Media says bilingual marketing is the future.
Not only bilingual in Spanish, but I think it's going to start incorporating other languages as well.
He says it's a reflection of the diverse multicultural ways future generations communicate. I'm Elizabeth Trovol for Marketplace.
Advertising, of course, takes many forms, cross-cultural, as Elizabeth was just talking about. Straight ahead, some are funny, sometimes ads are a little abstract. Also, false. For instance, what do the Burger King Whopper, the Subway tuna sandwich, and the Taco Bell Crunchwrap all have in common, hmm? Besides being, well, unexciting lunch options, they've all been the subject of recent false advertising litigation. And that is just the short list of a host of claims involving hundreds of products, food or otherwise, that have been deceptively marketed to the consuming public. Where, then, do courts draw the line between false advertising and just buyer beware? To answer that, we called Professor Rebecca Tushnet at Harvard Law, who teaches aspiring attorneys about these kinds of things. Professor, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Could we get a little ground truth here first? I suppose a little definitions here. What is, in the eyes of the law, false advertising?
False advertising is essentially a broken promise. You promised something that you didn't deliver that matters to the consumer, that is a reason that they might want to buy something.
So you gave two parts of the answer there. One was give them a reason and then consumers. And the reason I ask that is because it's reasonable consumer, right?
Right. There's always somebody unreasonable who, you know, expects the refrigerator never to break down. But there's also lots of reasonable expectations, even if they might be wrong. So it might be reasonable to think that, say, a medicine can last, you know, 24 hours, even if it's physically impossible for that particular medicine. Mm-hmm. But you're not supposed to know that as an average person on the street.
So it is an increasing issue, right? There are more complaints being made, more lawsuits being filed. What is going on?
So there's always a dynamic in the market where sellers are trying to get away with whatever they can get away with. And some of them are, you know, not overly concerned with the truth. One of the things I think we're seeing with the lawsuits actually is the collapse of other ways to regulate companies and also the inability to sue for a lot of the things that go on in our lives. So most of your life, you have signed contracts mm-hmm. with people saying, I promise not to sue you, and we'll arbitrate if there's a problem. So what's left is the stuff that you don't sign a contract for, the stuff that you buy in the store. So the $5 purchases or the fast food lunch, there you can still sue, and that's where the lawsuits are concentrating.
Yeah, a lot of fast food and a lot of food in general, right? Why is that the case?
It's because there's a lot of incentive to make promises or make suggestions to consumers. And then when the consumer says, hey, that didn't really happen, you say, well, it was always vague anyway. Like, what is natural, really? What is clean, really? And, you know, it's difficult because, of course, they want you to rely on it. And then they want to say, but it was too vague for any reasonable person to rely on it. So the dynamic here is somewhat unfortunate for the consumer.
Right, right. So what is the remedy for a wronged consumer? I mean, you know, there's this Burger King Whopper case where Burger Kings are actually, you know, not as big as they are advertised. And do we all get free Whoppers, or what's the solution?
So usually the consumer asks for a refund, so basically to reflect the difference between what they paid for and what they thought they were getting. There'd probably be a settlement, and, you know, anybody who had bought
a burger within the relevant time period could get 10 cents per burger or whatever. Mm-hmm. Most of the deterrent effect there just comes from, if it were to succeed, they would probably change some of their advertising and, you know, not do it again.
Entirely apart from the food and beverage and those things where you just buy stuff because you need stuff, this thing you mentioned about signing contracts and signing away your rights to sue and committing to arbitration, what's the net effect of that? Where do we go in the long run with that, right? Because that's kind of what this is all about.
Right. So the problem with that is it gives big companies the ability to basically nickel and dime you. And, you know, a nickel wrongfully taken from me is no big deal, but a nickel wrongfully taken from 100 million people is a lot of money. And so I think we do need to think about responding to these sort of large scale things, even when they're small individually. They just contribute to chipping away at us economically, which is not great.
Right. It's an erosion of consumer rights, right? In a consumer driven economy. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Rebecca Tushnet is a professor of law at Harvard University. Professor, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which I have failed you, because it turns out we are going to have another Jay Powell cut in the program.
I've always thought that the soft landing was a plausible outcome, that there was a path, really, to a soft landing. I've thought that, and I've said that since we lifted off. It's also possible that the path has narrowed and it's widened, apparently. Ultimately, this may be decided by factors that are outside our control.
These are the bumps that Goolsbee was talking about. The UAW strike, a maybe, but looking more likely every single day. Government shutdown, rising gas prices, student loan payments. Resuming, there is a lot going on right now. Let's just call the whole show a moment of economic context today, will you? Because I got to go. Media production around here. Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Jessen Dueler, Drew Jostedt, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Brizdahl. Tomorrow, see ya.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.